Hello and welcome to episode number 38 of the podcast More Than Tones, Music Education and Society. This episode was produced by Juan Esteban Rendon and Juliana Otto. They participated in our seminar Music Education and the Idea of Freedom and will introduce themselves in a second. A couple of weeks ago, they had the chance to have a digital conversation with Joseph Abramo, who is an associate professor of music education at the University of Connecticut. I'm very happy to present the first part of the conversation about the ideas of the Brazilian educator and philosopher Paulo Freire, and I hope you will enjoy listening to them as much as I did.
Acorda, amor. Eu tive pesadelo agora.
We would like to start this conversation talking a little bit about who we are and what we do in the world of music.
Yeah, so I study since 5 years here in Berlin, elementary school teacher for music, German and mathematics, but mainly for music. And my major instrument is cello. But I also like to write songs and play the guitar and play in a folk band.
My name is Juan Esteban. I study violin at UDK. My program is specialized in orchestral music, so all the traditional literature. And I love to do chamber music. That's like my thing. I started teaching in December in a music school here in Berlin.
Very nice. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to both of you. So I studied in school. I studied classical saxophone, which is its own sort of unique, crazy thing. I even wound up getting a master's degree in it, and it was something that I enjoyed at the time. But, you know, it's such a niche thing that I haven't been able to do a lot of it since then. So as you can probably see in the back here, I do a lot more sort of pop music stuff now. Like, I do play a lot more guitar and that sort of stuff. I teach what we call instrumental music, so that would be in the U.S. would be band and orchestra. So I teach undergraduates how to teach in those settings. So that is what we might consider a more traditional course, where it deals with what is traditionally taught in schools. In addition to that, I also teach a pop music course, the teaching of pop music in schools. And so we spend a lot of time, you know, learning the instruments, but also thinking about how education in popular music might be different than education of classical music, and the ways that they're obviously similar too.
Okay, so I think many people who hear this podcast chapter have never come across the name of Paulo Freire. So we would like to ask you, if you had to tell these people who Paulo Freire was, how would you describe him in short words?
I would describe Freire as Brazilian Marxist who was part of the government at one point and was very interested in helping very oppressed people have access to more education and more power. So a lot of his work was in the rural areas of Brazil, as well as Sao Paulo, the city. And the people that he worked with were very downtrodden, right? They were people who were often illiterate. They were peasants. They were people who were exploited. And when it comes down to it, Freire was devoted his life to trying to help those people to live better lives. Yeah.
And why did you decide to teach Freire and his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed?
When I started teaching a philosophy course at University of Connecticut, where I am now, I thought it was important to include that text. I mean, it's one of the foundational texts in education. I'm of the belief that everybody who's in education should read it, because it's got a lot of interesting things in there. And, You know, the thing that I love about it and the thing that I love about good texts in general is that every time you come back to it, it gives you something different and something new to focus in on and to think about.
So it was 100% like your decision to include it in your curriculum.
Yeah. Okay. Again, because, I mean, Freire might not like this idea. I wonder what he would think of it, but it's like, it's canon. It is canon at this point. It's like Beethoven. It's like Mozart. You kind of have to do it, right? He might not like that very idea, but I do think that it's important that everyone reads it because of that.
I have to say, coming from Colombia, I had a very particular feeling reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I felt reading a book that would be prohibited in some countries because it would be considered too communist, too Marxist. And because of the place I come, I had to think, wow, like probably in another time and place, I wouldn't have had the chance to read this text.
Yeah, I mean, so I purposefully, with my students, de-emphasize, well, I do bring it up a little bit, but I purposely don't try to bring up the communist aspects of that text. And maybe that's a problem, right? Because, you know, for example, in the United States, there are places where Freire is still banned. An important example of this was that in the state of Arizona, which has a large Latino population in it because it's borders with Mexico, particularly in Tucson, which is very close to the border, the school district had a Latino studies course in a high school, and they read some Freire, and the state legislature banned that whole course and that book. So even in the United States, it still continues to be, because of its communist aspects, something that, you know, is banned and stuff. Now, our relationship in the United States to communism is obviously very different than South America. As you read Freire, right, he's a lot more sympathetic to, well, Lenin and Mao, which I think is a problem at time. He's also very sympathetic towards Che Guevara and Castro. And so in the United States, it's very different than that, right? These are you know, like boogeymen. they're considered like evil people in the United States by the traditional powers. So those are all things that, frankly, I don't want to engage in very much with, because I'm much more interested to bring to my students the ideas that are so related to practice with these students, you know, the idea of banking education and what does it mean to dialogue with students.
Freire proposed a dichotomy between banking education versus problem-posing education. In banking education, teachers deposit information into students as if they were mere vessels. In problem-posing education, a thematic is used to start a conversation between teachers and students where everyone contributes with their own insight.
So I'm much more interested in pulling that part out for them rather than getting into the geopolitical aspects of the text.
Because it could potentially make some students close themselves to the idea that they could learn from Freire?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned that you work with ensembles in schools, and I think we can relate that to Pedagogy of the Oppressed in the sense that when we talk about ensembles, we talk about hierarchical structures too. For example, I work in an orchestra and I feel the structure all over the place. And Freire, he talks a lot about it when commenting the Hegelian dialectic of master-slave. So I would be really interested in asking you if you think it is possible to have liberty inside hierarchical structures, such as music schools or professional orchestras?
Ah, yes. I think that this is such an important, interesting question, right? So if we think about a traditional orchestra, it is very hierarchical, of course, as we all know. The conductor has the artistic vision, and everyone else just kind of adheres to that. Just to give you a very quick story about that, my brother is a professional orchestral musician. He plays bass in the section of the Nashville Symphony, which Nashville is, you know, part of the United States. is a city. Actually, it's known for country music. But anyway, he plays in there. And I remember when he was getting his auditions ready, he had to play the famous excerpt towards the beginning of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the fourth movement, where the bassist play the melody first. And he played it for me, and I said, oh, that's really interesting. You might want to, like, push through the phrase here, right? And that sort of stuff. He's like, no. I was like, what do you mean? He said, no. Well, you know what they're looking for? They're looking for that you play as square as possible with perfect time so that the conductor can tell you later how he wants it shaped. And I was, you know, as someone who, you know, is not in the orchestral world, I was, like, taken aback by that. I was like, that sounds awful. You know,
it does.
You're just raw material that the conductor exploits for his, it's all, almost always his vision. And that's the structure that's there, right? And it's efficient in some ways, right? It becomes a much more messy process when that happens. Now, the classic example that at least we know, we talk about all the time in the United States, and I'm sure people know in Europe as well, is the Orpheus Ensemble. So they don't have a conductor, and they have a very particular structure where the section leaders come together and they do interpretive things. So it tends to be a much more democratic process. And so clearly it is possible, even on the professional level, that these sorts of things can happen. I mean, the question, of course, would remain, can you do that with Rite of Spring, for example? You know, when you've got 100 people in there, there is the simple fact of you need someone waving their arms to keep us in time on a piece like that. But the bigger the group, the harder I think that becomes. And Orpheus tends to be more of a chamber ensemble. So that's the question on the professional level. I think on the student level, I think there's two questions. I think it can be done, all right? And I think it has to be done to a certain degree, right? Asking students to make interpretive decisions, not just banking, not just telling them like a conductor does in a traditional professional ensemble. But here's the crux of the question, and I don't have an answer on this, but it's hard to do. So the question becomes, yes, we can make ensembles democratic. It tends to be really hard. Is it worth the time? Or do we scrap it and go somewhere else? And I think that that is a question that, at least for me, is open to debate. Because we want to honor that tradition, and it's important to play in those groups. But if it continually butts up against, for example, a Frarian way of doing it, maybe we need to jettison it. And I don't think there's clear answers on that. I don't think there's clear answers.
Yeah, I think for me, the question is, how do you find liberty inside the structure when possible? But the other question is, what happens when people don't want to find this liberty? And it has a lot to do with Freire too. Even psychologists, they talk, when they talk about the job of being an orchestral musician, they talk about people whose work is trying to make the wishes of a person true, but not their own wishes. And even some psychologists, they talk about the repercussions in their personal lives of having such a job, right? But Freire also talks about what happens when people or the oppressed have fear of liberty. So I think this comparison is really interesting. And of course, thinking about students and the new generations learning music, of course.
Yeah. You know, what this makes me think about is, again, another sort of issue. So in the United States, again, there is a big push against ensembles. I think in general, the academics have questioned the sort of limits of ensembles. And then there are a lot of people who push back. And one of the things they say is, well, what about the kids who do like to sit in an ensemble and listen to somebody tell them what to do? And that's the type of music making they want. And it brings up the very issue that you just brought there, right? And brings in what Freire says about all this stuff. They have the, Freire would say, they have the oppressor within them, right? And so it is our job to kind of liberate them from. And I think that this ultimately gets at such an important thing. So, you know, of course, in the United States, we are obsessed with free choice, right? This is part of the market that we are the worst of capitalist systems here in the US, where as long as someone has free choice, then they're free. This is the way that we think about it. And Freire, of course, you know, just blows that up and says, well, free choice isn't free choice, right? It's if you want something that's bad for you, that's not your free choice. That's something that's put in place. And that, again, that's a sort of open question, is like, well, but if a kid doesn't want to sit in an ensemble and that is their, quote, free choice, should we have that available for them? Or should we take an approach that is probably more Freirean, which is to question why they want that, right? You might guess that I probably am venturing more towards the Freirean aspect of saying, well, let's make this a problem, right, as he says. Why do you want to sit here and just listen to people tell you things? But why do you like that? That sort of thing.
The why. And yeah, the book talks about that. I think it's so strongly written, like the force of the word why.
Always why. That's right.
So we also thought about this question, of course. So I thought about it as an upcoming teacher. And I think Juan also thought about it as an upcoming violinist. And my opinion was that maybe if the students get the ability to play music, they need to get so many other abilities, like to reflect their feelings, to reflect how do I play it and how would other people listen to it and which kind of feeling do they have when they listen to my music. So we thought that maybe it's also a process of getting more liberate to play music also in a group because of the experiences you make. Although that playing in the same time is an act of maybe being oppressed because you need to follow the conductor wants you to play.
Yeah, I mean, that's the wonderful thing about an ensemble, right? In the original French word, is it's a collective, right? It's a coming together. And in that sense, it is actually very close to dialogue, or it facilitates dialogue. Although, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, again, another thing that has popped out to me recently is Freire says, when he's talking about his culture circles and dialogue, he says it can't be more than 20 people. This is what he says at one point. And so if you think about an ensemble, it tends to be bigger than that. And so I think that that is a sort of problem. But I think that you've brought up such an important point, which is that ensembles bring people together in a way that, for example, songwriting can, but songwriting tends to be that solitary act, or a group of two people, for example, or something, writing a song together, versus an ensemble is that collective thing. And so that's a strength there that we should exploit as teachers.
I think a lot of people aren't willing to ask themselves this kind of questions, because it's not easy in the end. Like, if your job is to play an instrument every day and the whole day, and then you start thinking about why did you choose that instrument? If it was a free choice that you started playing double bass in the case of your brother, then it makes everything more difficult. Yeah, well, maybe you're not so motivated the next day to start practicing scales, I don't know. So not everybody's willing to ask these tough questions that maybe in the end would liberate you in a way, in the same sense that not every person has the empathy of thinking, what's the person in front of me living? What's his or her reality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do feel that with colleagues, like some of them would preferably only play in an ensemble, have a job, and think about family projects, building a place, buying a car. Even in the artistic world, that you would argue it's not about profit or capital. But in the end, there are people that through art are trying to have a standard life.
You mean even artists want to settle one day?
Yeah, I'm not saying that we artists have to starve although there are radicals that do think like art is in starving or whatever.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you're saying all this, because one thing is, I think you're pointing at is, and this becomes incredibly clear when we talk about orchestral musicians, is that they are laborers, and it's easy to forget that. We often think of them as artists, but in an orchestra, for example, I mean, you are a laborer. There are contracts. You show up. You're there to execute a very particular thing, and if you can't do that, you're fired. You know, and so there's that aspect of it. And when we remember the labor part of it, I actually think that that makes us go back to Freire and think a little bit about what he's saying, which is that maybe there's some comfort in him calling for revolution, right? So you're saying there are people who, like you're saying the example of somebody who, I'm an orchestral musician, if I think too hard about why am I playing the bass and what does it mean to play scales and is violent, that stuff, if you get trapped in that world too much, you might literally get fired. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so there's some privilege and comfort in calling for revolution when there are people out there that, yes, are part of systems, but they don't have the luxury to have that time to think about it. And I think Freire is saying that, but also the risks are way higher for them than, you know, someone who can kind of sit outside that, like me as a professor who gets to sit around and think all day, right? You know, I just think that that's an interesting aspect to it that I don't know if there's an answer to it, but, you know, we always got to remember that musicians are, professional musicians are laborers as well.
Não esqueça a escova, o sabonete, o violão.
This was episode number 38 of the podcast More Than Tones. In the upcoming episode, Juan Esteban, Juliana and Joseph will continue to talk about the realization of Paulo Freire's ideas and focus on music education in music classrooms. One of their topics will be the question, which contents we choose to teach.
Bach, for example, has sustained me in my life. He's someone who I continually come back to and listen to. I personally don't believe it is violent to teach students about Bach.
I'm really looking forward to the second part of your conversation and thank the three of you for your contributions to this podcast. Dear listeners, if you are interested in the other English episodes of this podcast series, please scroll down to number 13, which was published in March 2020, and number 25, 26, and 27, which were published in September and October 2020. It's always nice to get some feedback and get to know other people's thoughts about the topics we talk about. That's why we invite you to comment on our episodes on Facebook or on the blog www.mehralsto.de. On this website, you will also find a space for your comments and suggestions. The second part of Juan Esteban's, Juliana's and Joseph's conversation will be published in 2 weeks. Stay tuned and healthy, and in the meantime, enjoy making and listening to music.